boys and girls, Giant Time's here.
That's right! We are at the very end of Friday the 13th, Part 5! Oh, thank you, Jason!
On Kill by Kill.
Well, greetings and salutations, killers. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Camp Crystal Lake adjacent or something. This movie doesn't want to tell, so why should I tell you? And it's the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. We're going to unpack all the gory details of Friday the 13th Part 5 in the hopes that a camper's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes we can tell about them. And as always, we journey into this fraught barn of doom with the only person I trust to let me know how much gas is in that chainsaw, the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
Well, Patrick, you know, I'm feeling a little bit of relief and yet also a touch of sorrow. I sort of feel like Sam and Frodo at the end of the Return of the King.
Oh my God, that takes a long time. Are you sure you want it to be that long?
When the ring has been destroyed and Sauron has been defeated, mm-hmm. and yet the our heroes, Frodo and Sam, lay in each other's arms, battered, bruised, exhausted, feeling that there's no hope for rescue, and they talk about the things that they would have liked to have done had they made it back to the Shire. I sort of feel like we've gotten to this point where we're just, you know, we've reached the end of our hero's journey, but we may not make it back from this.
It's entirely possible that the light at the end of the tunnel is actually a raging tractor headed our way, and we just flail our arms up in the sky like, I don't know what a tractor is. What's heading towards me? And then it hits us.
There are worse ways to go.
Or you could survive it inexorably. I don't know how you manage to survive it, and yet Roy does. Anyways, we will get to that. You know what, Gina, though? We're not going to cap off Friday the 13th Part 5 alone. No. We have brought along a special guest. May I introduce one half of both the Revisionist and the Stage of Fools podcast, Mr. Zach Powers. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you guys?
We're good. But listen, this is it.
I mean, next 2 weeks from now, you guys get to start Jason Lives. Ian McKellen will wake you up on your sunlit bed, and it'll all be right in the world.
Oh my God, that would be the best.
Patrick will get to see his rosy cotton again.
Exactly so.
How many J.R.R. Tolkien references will we be able to fit into this one edition of the podcast? I don't know.
New mini game on the show.
Yeah, just I think we're starting to pick up a trend of literary references that don't really belong. We've gotten Tennessee Williams, we've gotten Of Mice and Men. Now we've thrown in Lord of the Rings movies. I think this could be a running gag. This could be the new hashtag. Yeah.
I think Part 5 warrants the grimness of a George R.R. Martin, personally, but...
I hadn't even thought of that comparison. Everybody dies, pretty much. Yeah, that's a good one. I hadn't even thought of that one.
Yeah, Thunderstorm is coming, I suppose, is what we always knew it would happen. So, Zach, I ask you, as I ask all of our guests, what was your first introduction to the Friday the 13th franchise?
Well, my relationship with the Friday the 13th franchise goes back pretty far. When I was a youngster, probably in first or second grade, after a night, a Halloween night of collecting candies, I came back to my house and I turned on the teeny tiny TV I had in my room, and on TBS or USA or one of those channels that used to air a lot of edited horror movies, they were playing Friday the 13th Part 2. And I stayed up late watching it. And over the next few years, I sought out, at an age too young to do so probably, the remaining movies. I joined an internet forum dedicated to Friday the 13th. When I was approximately 12 years old in 2001.
Well, that's the perfect time to talk to strangers about horror movies.
Oh, I went deep, too. I stayed there for years. I did not have a great deal of friends in middle school and early high school, and they became my surrogate social community during that time, to the degree that when I was 16, for some unknown reason, my parents allowed me to fly to St. Louis to go to a rented out campground with a bunch of strangers from the internet who were older than me, for the weekend, which was the first place I ever got drunk.
And yet somehow you're still sitting here telling us this story.
Somehow I am still friends with these people. Like, they shaped some of my political... It was like the height of George W. Bush's war on terror. They shaped a lot of my political beliefs. They made me... They helped me through the most embarrassing time of my life. And, yeah. I started the forum. This is an extraordinarily embarrassing detail. I later became a moderator, but when I started, I had the nickname... Me, at 12 years old, Spawn of Evil was the moniker I chose, which I later reduced to SOE out of pure embarrassment.
I can top that. When I was well into my 20s, my chat handle for a little while, because I was a Rob Zombie fan, was Living Dead Girl. And because I was, I'm a little bit older than you, so I was, I came of age during the grunge era. Sure. So the girl in Living Dead Girl was spelled with two R's.
Oh, sure. Classic sure. Avril Lavigne kind of style on that one.
That story is like one twist away from being a really bad outcome Lifetime movie. And yet here you are, like a better person for it. So...
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still, like I said, I'm friends with a lot of those people still, and I see them posting pictures, mostly protesting Donald Trump, I'll be honest, but yeah, still friends with all of them.
So, this brings us once again, because this film is no home to common sense, we are at the end of this particular motion picture. We're wrapping things up. And so, I could give you a long list of who's left alive, but almost no one is left alive, so... Let's start this off where we ended last time, which is Reggie waking up from his old movie from the 50s induced nap to a lightning storm. Mm. And the first thing that Reggie says out loud is, what are those nuts up to now? Yeah. Now, my question to the both of you is, does he believe that lightning storms are caused by crazy people, or is he hearing, or was he told he was going to hear something that the audience don't hear?
I have a guess, I suppose.
Sure, go for it.
So the previous two victims, Violet and the guy whose mental instability was apparently that he stuttered.
It's hilarious. No one could ever remember his name. I think every guest we've had has called him Josh, Jack, and pretty much every other variation of J names. Like,
I think he might get called both Josh and Jack in the movie. I think he's first introduced as Josh and later is called Jack. Like, seriously, honest to God.
But in the credits, he's Jake.
Really? I almost want to rewatch because I swear to God, they call him two different names and neither of them is Jake.
Welcome to Friday the 13th Part 5. Where nothing is as it seems, and anyone's name could be anything you want it to be.
They were watching this movie with Reggie, and Jack very openly comes onto Violet, assumedly with Reggie just off frame? Is he there for that entire interaction?
Well, he was asleep, I think.
Well, hopefully. Jack, Josh does start to yell near the end of that interaction pretty loudly.
Well, this is a kid who's living at a halfway house. I mean, he's probably seen some shit.
Probably,
one of the residents clumsily hitting on another resident is among the less traumatizing things he's witnessed.
One of just them in the killed past another few one days. With an axe just days ago.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, whatever. He's hitting on her. I'm just gonna sleep right through this. I mean, really, how many? Who among us has not pretended to sleep through a friend clumsily hitting on another friend?
No, that's true.
Absolutely, anyone who went to college. So he wanders upstairs, and immediately goes to whose room has he gone to? Isn't it? Because he says Tommy when he.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. All I can note, the only thing I noticed about that scene is when he's knocking on the door, you can see that big old no handball playing sign right over his shoulder.
Again, well, all right, Zach. We've asked this 2 weeks in a row. What? Who's playing handball so loud in that fucking hallway? It's a tiny hallway. How do you play handball in it? And how do you play handball so much in it that they're like, we need to put a big fucking sign that says, don't play handball in here?
I don't know. One. Two, I'm not really sure what handball is. I just assumed it was a metaphor for masturbation.
That makes sense. In a halfway house, there's probably going to be at least one resident just whipping it out without any sort of regard for his surroundings.
Josh is totally handballing it up.
I didn't even think of that. That is an excellent, completely plausible theory.
That's the most plausible theory anyone's come up with, so I'm very glad I asked. Anyways, he bursts then into Tommy Jarvis 2.0's room and discovers a pile of bodies. And sure. So this brings up we're now into the portion of the movie, which mm-hmm. has been an ongoing theme here on the Kill by Kill podcast. And that is Jason Voorhees' interior/exterior decorator, where he subtly or not so subtly hides bodies in just the right place. So you discover them along the way. Only this is that section of the movie supersized, because all the bodies we're going to encounter, all the deaths that we're going to talk about, are previously killed people that happen to be in this movie and we just haven't seen in a while. Well, where have they been? They've been dead, apparently. So the threesome, that the menage a death that he happens upon here, is our previous trio. That's your Jake, Jack, Josh, your mm-hmm. Robin, and Violet. Robin still doesn't have a shirt. And she's piled on top. Oh, God. This movie just can't get enough boobs. And it's not the last pair of boobs we're going to see in this movie. It's almost over.
I think the craziest part about this is there's still like more than 20 minutes left of this movie. Like the you know, usually when you get to the point where Jason's tossing bodies through windows and all, which he does, mm-hmm. because that's a signature move. How Roy would know that, I have no idea, but there's still another 20 minutes of this.
It just goes on and on and on. Well,
I mean, to be fair, Jason aped, like many things, a lot of that final hide the body, find the body chase from Michael Myers, of course. And I guess Roy, through the same osmosis, picked it up off of. And I guess Jason wouldn't know that his mom did the same goddamn thing.
Well, that's why we always view it as a Voorhees family trait. Because he picked, you know, you may not always know everything that you do might come from your parents. Sure. And then you discover later on. Like, I always tell my kid, like, chill your biscuits. That's not something that I picked up as a vernacular from Glendale, California. That's sure. something my mom picked up from living in Kansas. So that's not something I've always viewed as, like, that was just a part of me. And then it erupts out of me in the appropriate situation. In that case, raising a kid. Here, it's, you know, hiding dead bodies so they can give people the woo scare.
Sure. The Easter morning Easter egg hunt was a grand tradition at the Voorhees household, I guess.
It might still be. We don't know where that head is.
The sure. deep-seated, vehement dislike of windows.
Yes.
He hates big picture windows. It's just a thing. You shouldn't be able to see that much. I mean, he sees everything behind a mask. So is that where the resentment comes from?
If I can't see anything, you people can't see anything.
It's just a fondness for limited fields of vision.
Reggie lets loose one of his patent, awesome, high-pitched screams, which I think is probably the best thing about this movie, is that kid's scream. It's glorious.
It's pretty hilariously girly.
It's you don't anticipate it coming out of him, and every time it does, it's a delightful surprise. I love it because it feels actually genuine.
The family of Reggie is by far the most likable and interesting characters in this movie, and I honestly wish Tommy didn't need to be in this fucking thing. They should have focused on that family, Demon and Reggie and the grandfather, as kind of the de facto protagonists of this thing and cut all the bullshit with Tommy straight up.
Oh, yeah, totally. They are our entire episode on Demon and his girlfriend Anita was how these characters were completely superfluous and that Roy should not have had any. They had nothing to do. They weren't even in town when Joey. They weren't even in town when he was murdered. And again, likable, completely useless characters that the movie would have been considerably more entertaining if more focus had been put on them.
Yeah, I would have liked that a sort of part four dynamic, where you have a satellite family and then an interior of kids whose partying sort of awakens a mass murderer. That would have probably been a more interesting movie and would have drawn from a better place. Instead, as we've said many times, Friday Part 5 learns all the wrong lessons and then applies them in the most haphazard, stupid way possible.
Sure. Tommy's whole reason d'etre is to basically be, one, connective tissue to the previous movies, which isn't really necessary, and because none of the previous ones had that, and two, to be a possible suspect for the killer, but they do the mystery game so poorly that it really doesn't matter. They don't have scenes of characters wondering, oh, who's the killer, except the cops barely at all speculating about it.
Yeah, this film's idea of a red herring is a bag of Swedish fish. Right. You don't even know what the fuck to do with it.
Yeah, it's also a strange... they take the strange and unusual tactic of making the protagonist of the movie disappear for long stretches of time. Yeah. And also have the least amount of dialogue in the movie. I mean, Tommy gets maybe a dozen lines in the entire movie just spread out over an hour 45 minutes.
Sure. He's been gone before Demon died, and he doesn't show up for another 10 minutes at least.
Yeah, there's about at least a half hour stretch in the movie where he is not even in it.
That brings up this. I mean, in another film, you might think this is some sort of brave expansion or busting open the tropes, because there's no real defined final girl and there's no actual hero journey. There's a lot of things that you could say are really expanding what a Friday the 13th movie is. It's just done so poorly and so haphazardly. It's like random. They're pulling names out of a hat, like, who haven't we seen in a while? Mm-hmm. And it's filled with so many extraneous characters that you just lose track of it. So
I feel
is
like that's...
Pam our final girl? I would almost put Reggie in that role. He's better suited to it, and I actually like him.
Well, I'll say one, I'm going to say Pam is the final girl just because I want to call her the final Pam. And two, this section of the movie is especially guilty of what you're talking about, because there's a number of characters whose bodies have not been found at this point that could easily replace these characters that they're throwing through the window. If you want eye damage, Tina is sitting out in the woods somewhere. Throw her through a fucking window. Then you have more time to develop a couple of these characters earlier in the movie.
I agree.
Have him actually kill the guy that's responsible for his son's death.
That would be a logical thing for a person to do, would it not?
How hard would it... I mean, especially you would figure that Roy would probably be familiar with the local police constabulary. So why not have him walk into the jail cell and kill the guy that actually is responsible for his son's death?
Based and on either, the police work these people do, they cannot run all that tight of a county jail.
Yeah, he literally could walk in with the Jason mask and no one would bat an eye.
It would add tension to this if Vic mysteriously disappeared from jail and then everyone's like, oh my God, Vic's on the loose, and assume that Vic is on some sort of revenge mission where he's going to kill everyone. That would add tension to this. Instead, they don't develop it at all, and it just sits there. And then they kill off ancillary characters or people they just introduce as a body count until we get to this point. And then it's like, ooh, well, we got to start throwing some dead bodies so we can explain that this person is dead now.
And
it's
that's
nuts.
A 10 times better. If you think Rick's the killer the whole time, Vic is the killer the whole time, that twist is 10 times better than what we get in this goddamn thing.
Pam arrives on the scene after Reggie's scream of doom, and she tries to get him to focus. Like, Reggie, what's wrong? Reggie, what's wrong? And when she reaches the fourth version of Reggie, tell me what's the matter, it's almost like, kid, say you're lying. That's how it comes across. And then he just kind of head motions that the reason he screamed or is upset is in the other room. Mm-hmm. And she walks in there and we wait a full 5 seconds. And then finally a lightning strike. And then she backs up out of it like, again, stab wounds are catching. and then they haul ass down the stairs. And that's about the only genuine reaction in the entire thing. And then it completely goes off the rails again. They hustle on down the stairs, and then they try to make it across the kitchen, and she practically throws him to the ground.
Yeah. It's a little much. And then she's kind of yelling at him to get up in a very unhelpful way, I would say.
And she totally blamed him. Get up! Like, I'm tired of you keeping us from getting out of this house instead of, we need, like, urgency. There's a lot of move going on here. Like, I think he gets it. It's time to move. And then Roy bursts through the door and the door explodes. Let's get this straight. The door explodes from him kicking it.
Sure. And another signature Jason Voorhees move that he could not have possibly known about. Unless he'd seen the earlier movies.
Jason uses his whole fucking body. He just kicks it. It's a low kick. And then the door explodes. I mean, did he learn that in paramedic school?
I mean, but to be fair, yes. Historically, Friday the 13th killers, if they were a Pokemon, the type they would be strong against is door type. They can tear them apart.
Door entrances and exits, portals, as you were, are, particularly vulnerable to his type of attack. Yes, the door, just as if TNT is attached to it, explodes. And then they just look at this shaft of light with a guy in a Jason mask, blacked out eyes. This is important. Completely blacked out eyes. Now, the blacked out eyes thing in the hockey mask goes back a ways because people generally don't want to wear that much makeup underneath that fucking mask. You don't want to have a whole to-do and then wander around doing stunts in it. But later on, the blackout eyes disappear. Mm. And you can clearly see it is not Jason Voorhees because, as Gina has so often noted, we don't have the fried egg guy.
Right. Right.
Well, you can also see that he is, like, unfit middle-aged man wearing this jumpsuit. Whereas before he was like, hanging out at Gold's Gym every week, every other day. You could definitely see, that it's not Jason Voorhees. I mean, not that anybody ever really thought that it could have been, but because I think this is the first time you really got a full view of him.
I don't think this is the first time you see the mask, I think, in the entire movie.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. We've only seen hands.
Yeah, that's not him. No, come on. And it's probably not Tommy either, because Tommy is fucking jacked in this.
And, Roy really did put a lot of effort into this costume, as we'll talk about later. I don't know why he didn't extend that to the body and just go for the whole nine yards. A little padding wouldn't have hurt if he's going to get hit by tractors and shit. But
you would think, yeah. You would think he would prepare himself.
I'll give this to the movie. I always did like the touch that in the dream sequences and when you see Jason as a hallucination later on, he has the red triangles on his mask. I like that for the fake killer, they went with those blue triangles to differentiate between the two.
It's the only successful costuming maneuver in the entire thing. For example, this is... Pam is running around, and I know not everyone chooses their footwear based on the idea that later that night they're going to get chased by a machete-wielding maniac. She is wearing these urban cowboy boots with heels on them.
Yeah, and through muddy, like, rainwater-filled dirt.
It's amazing she lasts as long as she does.
Yeah, there's a lot of slipping and falling down in this sequence from both her and from Reggie.
It's a lot of tripping and a lot of falling. This place seems to be full of bushes as opposed to any other part of Crystal Lake or its adjacent environs. Mm-hmm. And they go a rumbling and a stumbling out towards the road. I guess that's their main objective. Along the way, Pam both loses and regains her pink sweater.
Right.
For reasons I can't begin to tell you. And they happen upon the ambulance. They open the driver's side door, and who do they find but Duke. His throat has been slashed, and he still has gum in his mouth.
Yeah, a character from the first 10 minutes of the movie that is never seen again, and the audience is supposed to immediately remember who it is.
Yeah, get ready for a lot of that in the next 15 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much. That is the theme of this movie. Remember this character? No. Well, look at him anyway. They're dead.
He's totally dead now. Before, he was not dead. Now he's freshly dead.
Yeah, that counts as a character arc in this movie.
He was alive, and now he is dead.
I love that they put gum in his mouth. Just so you go, remember that guy who had gum? He's dead.
I guess they figured that was, you know, a little more subtle than having him found with a porn mag in his hand. He died like he lived.
But that would confuse him with our other porn loving individual, although they don't look Billy. Billy's
oh, right, right, right. Yeah, that is, yeah. Well, everybody in this town is a scumbag, so.
Again, Friday the 13th, if you are an ambulance driver or associated with transporting sick or infirmed people, you're automatically assumed to be a complete scumbag. It's just,
what do these writers have against the EMTs?
That is a damn good question, because it comes up over and over and over again. It's just like the dream that they have to finally capture all the awe of watching a dude shit on camera. It's like, well, how can I figure out another way to see a dude take a dump?
You know, I feel like in this series, a lot of the cops are also either wildly incompetent or kind of assholes. So maybe they just hate anything that provides like a public service to the community. A little bit of an Ayn Rand streak going through them.
Yeah, they hate our first responders. RIPD, Duke, you spoke like, I think you were an under five. Honestly,
we
he
literally
might have been an under five.
We literally hardly knew ye.
And then, apropos of nothing, out of nowhere, Roy has zagged on him. And he's on the other side of the ambulance.
Yeah, I was trying to think of ponder the physics of that, and I was like, fuck it, why am I even trying to figure out how that was possible?
Yeah, Zach and I were briefly discussing before you came on air that what we have here, and I wish I'd brought this up during My Bloody Valentine, because it really applies there, but it also applies here. We got ourselves a Mrs. Doubtfire situation happening here. Where someone is able to both transport themselves in between places and change almost completely. Whereas now Roy does not have blacked out eyes. We can plainly see he is sans fried eye egg. And he's just like standing there like, hey, you know who's ready to kill you? This guy right here. Bang.
And he tried to do the two thumbs thing, but he had that machete. It made it awkward.
Yeah, he almost stabbed himself in the neck. Just trying to be a cool dude. Reggie sees this and says, like, you can practically see cartoon dust emerge from him as he hauls ass in the other direction and says, fuck this. He leaves Pam to die, basically.
He speaks to the audience when he leaves immediately saying, fuck this.
And to which Pam is like, Reggie? And she's speaking to his shadow, who is the only thing he's leaving behind, because he's traveling so much faster than she is because she's got those fucking heels on. Meanwhile, Roy is at a light trot. He's not even really at a full pace. Like, I walk faster walking a dog than he is. Along the way, we get a lot of swatting away of brush. Which is super awesome. And we get the first appearance of Pam running. And the only way I can describe Pam running is if you've ever seen A Hard Day's Night, how the Beatles exaggeratedly run in music videos. That's how Pam runs in real life, away from a killer. And yeah, they run all the way back to the house. Pam finally, for the love of God, loses that pink sweater when she discovers Dr. Letter and his dead body has been nailed to a tree, but his throat has also been slit. So he gets a little bit of both.
It would have been a good one to see, because he must have put that nail right through his head while he was standing up and into that tree behind him. Quite a feat of strength on old Roy's part. I feel like the nail would have been enough. I don't know why the throat slitting happened. That's just excessive.
I wonder if the throat slitting is first and the nail's just there to keep him upright.
So you think he, like, killed him with the throat slit and then awkwardly held him up while he kind of pounded the nail through the head into the tree.
It's all open to interpretation because we show nothing. Yeah,
where's that third hand coming from?
Good question. Yeah.
Well, maybe
Have you ever tried to hang a picture? You need like three hands for that shit.
This is a full-grown man.
You know how hard it is to get my 6.5-year-old from my bed to his own bed when he's fallen asleep there on the odd night that he does.
That must be like trying to nail a sack of potatoes to something.
It's nuts. I don't even give it up to Roy. He ends up, I guess that we've entered a psycho strength era for Roy at this point.
Yeah, this was like an unrelated Final Destination death, like a passing train threw a spike through his head and a piece of glass slit his throat at the same time. That's the most likely explanation here, I think.
Sure. I mean, putting on the mask is some sort of, it's literally like the movie The Mask. It makes him like super strong because he's this kind of otherwise unassuming, unremarkable looking middle-aged man who's suddenly able to pick up people by their throats and nail a full-grown man to a tree and perhaps dance to Cuban Pete. We don't know. That could be in a deleted scene. Yeah, sure.
This has opened up an entire world to me. I'm sorry. Someone else is going to have to continue while I gather my thoughts.
I'm thinking about the mask as like a magical object. Like I'm thinking about it like the symbiote from Spider-Man 3, and I'm thinking about Roy getting like a shitty haircut and going to a jazz club, being a little rude to his girlfriend.
Well, you know, I sort of feel like with Jason Goes to Hell, that's kind of what they picked up and ran with. I mean, not exactly that the mask was doing it.
You're right, yeah.
But this is some sort of spirit that could be passed on to other people that suddenly makes you super strong and really creative in how you murder people.
Do we have a Friday the 13th Part 5 fan theory going here?
Oh, I think we might.
I think that definitely in Part 4, they hinted at the very end that this sort of thing with the weird Corey Feldman giving a evil stare to the camera was sort of a hint that, well, maybe this could be passed along like a cold.
To come back to our mini game, it's like Corey Feldman turned whatever this hot guy's name is, was carrying the one ring, manages to resist its charms, and then it sees its opportunity in Roy once he finally gets to the halfway house.
Oh my God.
Roy is the Smeagol of this movie.
He's very weak. He's very weak-willed and greedy, so it gets to work quickly on him.
Mm-hmm. We know that greed and hoarding runs in the family because his son has the same situation with chocolate bars. So, yeah,
I think we've got something here. We have cracked the code of this terrible movie.
Suckitcracked.com. We got to it first. Take that, website that doesn't know we exist. Okay. We punch up here, okay?
I'm writing my letter to Sean Cunningham as we speak.
Dear Paramount Pictures in 1985. So somehow, Dr. Letter is dead. R.I.P.D. We don't know how it all worked out, but we know you're dead as doornails now. And then Pam beats feet as fast as she possibly can. They get all the way back to the house. And this is where we get another reveal, as it were. And that is, they've forced this actress to huff it all over Hell and Gone in high heels and no bra. This is too much.
Now, to be fair, it's strongly implied that this is a town where bras are outlawed, like Footloose, kind of.
Listen, you shouldn't force a person to run in rain without a bra. That's just a bit much. It sounds like it was a hellacious experience, and that might just be just part of it, but oh boy.
I think that, honestly, the way this movie is, it's how grody it is. I mean, they could have gotten away with one more shower scene at the end where she's, you know, after such a traumatic experience, she just has to wash it all away. I'm absolutely positive they would have taken that opportunity.
I'm surprised they didn't. Yeah, they have six or so endings. They might have deleted that seventh one.
holy shit, we have yet another connection to Lord of the Rings. This has as many endings as Return of the King.
Well, the difference is every new ending in Return of the King at least sort of accomplishes something in terms of the story. None of the endings in this accomplish anything in terms of the story.
Now we're talking about this, though, I really would have loved a scene where Tommy's laying in the hospital bed and all the surviving characters just come and just start laughing for about 12 minutes straight.
Absolutely. And then he runs off to the Greylands or whatever they're called.
He like gets on a ship with, I don't know, whichever one of the Ginny from part two, sure. And they just float off to the great land of Crystal Lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the USS, I've seen enough of this shit. They're just all taking off all at the same time.
The USS has been.
Kill, 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 kill. Break, 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 break. Hey there, hi there, ho there. It's your old pal Patrick Hamilton breaking into the action ever so briefly to remind you of all the great podcasts that you can find at the Ear Trumpet Audio family of podcasts. You have your Pet Cemetery, Please Don't Send Me to Outer Space, Life Mark. Oh my gosh, so many great podcasts. I can't list them all. That would take me at least 30 more seconds, and we just don't have that kind of time. That being said, you can find all of it. Go on your Facebooks and find Ear Trumpet Audio, and you'll find all of the podcasts updating every single week. It's totally worth your time. Check it out. You should also check out some of the podcasts that have been very lovely to us in other avenues. Shows that have featured us or that we've had lots of great back and forth on social media and whatnot. I'm, of course, talking about Shockwaves and Scream 101. Some of the podcasts of our guests, like Ladies Love Paul Rudd, which is fantastic. That's Amy's podcast, and I love it to death. It's fantastic. You should also check out the Stage of Fools podcast, because I am personally tied in a weird way to the Royals, because we work on that show to deliver it to people. We help advertise it. And you know what? We're going to have some people on a little bit later that might be more directly connected to the Royals. So keep your fingers crossed for that. So much great stuff. I would also encourage you to check out shows like 80s All Over, which kind of covers the same territory that we do in a slightly different way. Or even Teen Creeps, which is a great podcast that if you have not heard it, it's brand new to Feral Audio, although they've been doing it for a little while. Great podcast. Please check it out today. And with that said, the body count continues. Kill, 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 kill. Break, 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 break. Yeah, Pam arrives back at the halfway house only to cross a picture window. And of course, you know what that means. That can't stand. We've got to throw a dead body through it. And in this case, it's poor George the cook, a guy who doesn't deserve any of this shit. No. His clothes, by the way, dry as a fucking bone. His eyes have been taken out for reasons who knows. They just like needed yet another injury to somebody. No. And he's breathing heavily.
Well, you know, you're flung through a window.
It's a callback to the heavily beating pulse on Anita, I guess.
As far as, like, portraying a dead body, I'll give him, like, a C-.
Well,
maybe they just didn't tell him when the camera was on. That is probably the most likely suspect.
Yeah, they signaled for action, but they forgot they put a bunch of fucking makeup in his eyes. He couldn't see it.
Couldn't see shit. Just breathing, like, normal. Mm-hmm. And they're like, all right, we got it. And he's like, you don't want to take another one with me not breathing? Moving on. And
we've got some nude shots to film. No time for this.
I was going to say, they can only do one shot of poor George. You know, they have a couple more boob takes they have to do. Priorities, man. Priorities.
Well, I'll say this about old George. I think he might be just about the most likable character in this thing. He seems like a nice old dude. And again, I wish they had focused on the Reckless family a little more. And a little less on a lot of these other idiots and assholes.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
100% for that, yeah. So, R.I.P.D., George, you deserved better. than this shitty movie and this nonsensical death that you were given. And so Pam screams at it. And then we get a close-up of his eye makeup. And again, Pam runs like Ringo, being chased by rabid fans. And here comes Roy. He's on the move. We see his shadow. And she's just beating feet towards the barn. It manages to trip yet again. She does not yell at herself to get up. She gives herself a lot of chances. And she just ends up doing a lot of downward dog in mud. And then Roy slowly, like he's got all the time in the world, comes up to her. And then out of nowhere, right before he's in striking position, he's got a machete up. He's ready to go. Out of nowhere, bang, the barn door explodes. And a tractor comes out of it. Who's at the helm? It's Reggie the Reckless. Finally, he's doing something reckless. And he heads directly towards Pam and Roy. Roy reacts to this tractor as if he's never seen a moving vehicle before. Mm. This is also when Roy has suddenly been given a neck appliance. Whereas before, he was just had a normal neck. Now he's been given a pseudo Jason neck.
Roy spends a lot of the last 15 minutes of the movie acting as though he's just been dropped out of a spaceship. Like he doesn't seem to know what to do when someone is bearing down on you with a moving vehicle. He seems mystified by the fact that once he recovers from being hit at almost full speed by this tractor, he is bleeding. He seems like baffled by this. Like why? Oh, that's right. I'm a human being.
He might have forgotten. I mean, this might be the most physical activity Roy has engaged in quite some time. He looks like a man who has lived the supplying life. Like, he hasn't exactly been pumping iron or doing a lot of...
He's an EMT. That's a very physical job. True.
He's also a deadbeat dad, though, and that's a very easy job.
Compared the two, they really offset one another. Yeah. I mean, he's at crossing guards level of physical activity from what I can see. He's driving everywhere, maybe hoisting up a body to put it on a gurney, but he's not running into burning buildings, Gene.
That's true. I wonder how much, prior to this, violence or need for medical response was going on in this town. Possibly not that much.
Well, no, it's actually a
sleepy little town.
That's if it is in fact Crystal Lake has seen incident after incident incident of bloody mayhem. So if they are in fact near Crystal Lake, he's seen a lot of action. If it is anywhere else, a normal amount of action, but not the sort that he's going to turn action hero or maniac killer before this. And if he has, the movie has decided not to tell us this. But he is sort of blinded by the light of this tractor and gets square hit in it 100%. And the noise it makes kind of sounds like a limp hit at a body bag.
Sure.
It doesn't really sound human. It sounds like if you dropped a duffel bag on a tile floor.
The Foley editing in this movie says, mwah, it's superb.
Maybe at this point he has put on his Mrs. Doubtfire bodysuit to make him look. He's been changing this entire sequence from black eye makeup to no black eye makeup to his facial sort of extra padding that he adds on there.
The weird appliance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe he put on a little bit of a bodysuit and that was the thump against that prosthetic flesh there.
So now we once again get a full look at the neck appliance he's put on out of nowhere. And he wakes up to try to grab Reggie and Pam. Reggie does not get the wet clothes treatment that Pam has. Pam is soaked to the bone. Reggie, dry as anything.
Oh, yeah. And in true idiot horror movie character fashion, rather than running for their lives, they stand there They don't just stand there. They edge a little closer to him. And then a little closer. And then a little closer. Just until Reggie is close enough for Roy to reach out and grab his leg.
Yeah.
What are they doing? Why are they slowly moving towards him?
Even prior to this, like, Reggie, after his sort of get away from her, you bitch moment with the tractor, he could still use that tractor to kind of finish him off or make sure he's good and dead, or at least pin him to the ground so he can't get up and come after them, but neglects to do so.
I guess if the idea is they want to know who it is, you can find out later. You can read in the paper who it is later. You do not have to stand there and you know, kind of, you know, move a little closer. Let's see, maybe we'll pick up the stick and take his mask off. No, yeah,
neither of you are in the Scooby gang. You don't need to pull the mask off of this villain to let the audience know who the fuck it is. You can just beat feet.
And imagine their disappointment when they do find out it is who it is, and they're like, well, who the hell is that? I've never seen this person in my life.
They echo the audience's sentiment.
Exactly, yeah.
And meanwhile, Roy has like the Grand Canyon of gore wounds in his chest. Mm-hmm. And he kind of looks at it like, how the fuck did that get there? Man, you took a tractor to the chest. God only knows what happened to your fucking shins. I don't know how, because you get hit two different ways when a tractor hits you. High and low, but somehow he only has the high.
Well, he's kind of hobbling around a little bit, and then when Tommy shows up and he gets his injuries, he's starting to hobble around. So it's like 7 or 8 minutes of these two dudes just kind of slowly, painstakingly chasing each other around. It's like watching a couple of dudes recovering from a car accident in a hospital. Just they're trying to beat each other to the restroom.
Well, before we get to the reemergence of poor Tommy Jarvis, we get Roy wandering into the barn, and he's looking for his two last victims. And Pam, out of nowhere, finds a chainsaw. And
why do they have a chainsaw? Why does this halfway house for mentally disturbed teenagers have a chainsaw?
They gave Vic an axe. I mean, I think his punishment was you only use the axe, you don't get access to the chainsaw.
After the first murder, it was like, okay, no more chainsaw privileges, just the axe.
Let's give the violent guy just an axe. I mean, there's only so many people he can kill with that, whereas a chainsaw, he could probably get a lot more. And so we have what we've always wanted in a Friday the 13th movie. A wet woman with a chainsaw fighting a one-handed man with a machete. And it's underwhelming, yeah, I'd say. In terms of a duel, this isn't quite the Princess Bride.
Roy has kind of a little bit of like a Darth Vader in that Obi-Wan Kenobi fight way of fending off his attacks, where he just kind of holds up the machete and that's good enough.
I agree with you there. It's a wounded old man fighting another person who doesn't quite know how to fight with a chainsaw. So that's realistic at least. But Pam does get in one good shot to his shoulder, and then the chainsaw runs out of gas.
Can I ask, is this... Now, there's a popular conception among some people that Jason's weapon of choice is a chainsaw. This is the first chainsaw that appears in the Friday the 13th series, is it not?
Whose popular conception is of this, and where have you found it?
You've never
it
seen
in
little drawings of Jason, and he always has a chainsaw with him. I feel like I see it a lot, where people just assume Jason has a kind of a chainsaw thing going on.
He definitely has that buzzsaw thing that happened from Part 7, which is that giant circular saw thing.
Yeah, that like weed whacker.
I think at a certain point he just claimed the machete. I mean, we never know where he seems to get the machetes from, but
a lot of them are imported, like enchiladas, into this town. People tend to drop off machetes near Voorhees. And, oh my god, the neck appliance is now gone. This movie is so fucking inconsistent. Tommy reappears as if he's a Wild West gunslinger, and they stare at one another forever.
Clearly, again, that's done to fake out the audience, which is, again, this no one's buying this, because Roy's kind of got that, is it you? Now, again, I don't think Jason would recognize Tommy, a 5 years older Tommy, because although, again, Jason's intelligence seems to depend on whatever whim of the screenwriter happens to be at that particular moment.
True.
You know, sometimes he's a feral animal. Sometimes he's an ace crack detective who can find anybody just, you know, by scent, I guess, or just is able to predict a person's moves in advance. But so, again, this is a fake out for an audience that already is not buying that this is the same Jason from the last three movies.
I mean, to be honest, when I watched this scene, the main thing I was unclear about is why Tommy went to this barn an unspecified amount of distance from the actual halfway house itself. Did he go to the house and find the bodies? Or did he just immediately decide, after running away from punching the old redneck guy, I guess I'll just wander on back to the barn and have a nice barn think for the night. Like, I'm not sure why he's here.
I just like that we've branded it a barn think.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Like a lot of things, it just because the script declared it.
He's needed. He was called to set, and therefore he is there.
Because the screenwriter's like, oh shit, we forgot Tommy.
Yeah, pretty
here
much.
Here he is. And he just stares at Jason / Roy forever and just wonders if he's still dreaming, wonders if what the meaning of life truly is. And Roy comes right over and slashes him in the chest. Like, he doesn't even move. This doesn't seem like a person who's survived a massacre before.
Based on the quality of that slash, it doesn't seem like somebody who committed a massacre before.
Well, his balance has been thrown off. I mean, he now has a chest injury. He now has a shoulder injury. Things are not working the same for him. So maybe his judgment of distance, he's losing blood.
Sure.
So I'll give him that. And then lo and behold, that knife that we first encountered when he first arrived at the halfway house makes its Chekhov's knife. And we thought it would never appear again. But lo, here it is. He pops it right out at the right moment. And as Jason is about to finish him off, he stabs him in the groin. Now, that probably is the most brutal thing in this entire movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
For the femoral artery, not fucking playing around.
Yeah, pretty upper thigh-ish, but yeah, pretty narrow shot there.
I mean, he also has a chest injury, so who knows what he was really aiming for, but what he gets is real high upper thigh, and Roy seems to be okay with it. He's moving a little slower, but I have to believe he is running out of time at this point. When you've got that much blood coming out of you at one go, unless he gives it a quick suture and we just don't see it, but he manages to make it
up. Well, maybe while he was taking off his neck flap, he kind of stitched himself up a little bit.
I mean, he is an EMT. He would.
True.
He should know, at minimum, basic first aid.
Roy / Jason makes it up to the second story and is, I don't know if Tommy has passed out, in which case, the fuck you doing? You have one injury. Roy's running around bleeding from so many places, I can't even tell you where they all are. Meanwhile, he's like, oh, the vapors, and he's out. Or he's playing possum. I can't tell you which.
Oh. Tommy very barely justifies his heroic last-minute entrance. He helps very little.
He really does, doesn't he? He does not... up until the very last minute, he's not helping.
No. No.
No, it's a semi-team effort in which he takes all the glory for at the end. When it's really, spoiler alert, it's really Reggie who's the hero of the day, I think, in this. Because he's the one who puts himself in harm's way in order to lure Jason / Roy out. And then Pam starts taking to him with an axe handle, like she's in The Quiet Man all of a sudden. Then she looks out an open barn door and spies this. I guess is that what you put hay on, that thing with all the spikes on it?
No idea what the practical purpose of this bed of spikes is.
Is this barn on the same property as the halfway house? I mean,
it
is, right?
It's
their barn.
Absolutely.
So what are the? But I mean, there's no animals on this farm.
Well, that's where they kept the tractor. That's where we saw Vic on the tractor.
But what are they tractoring?
Hay?
There's no hay!
There's hay in the barn.
They just store their incredibly dangerous things, like their chainsaws and their beds of spikes, which, of course...
The only thing the halfway house seems to produce is laundry.
Yeah.
An endless amount of laundry that needs to be hung.
I also think it's a failure of basic safety procedures to leave your bed of spikes directly under the railless barn, like, window. I think that's
That's a tetanus shot waiting to happen.
Yeah, at the minimum, yeah.
I think we might have solved the mystery of the bed of spikes. But yeah, Reggie gives him a good shove. When he's not looking, gives him a hi-ya from the rafters, and you think, oh no, he's gone. He's totally gone. Nope. This is Die Hard before it's Die Hard. Who's hanging outside the window? That's one Jason fucking Voorhees, and it doesn't matter how many places he's bleeding from. He's going to take Reggie with him.
You're right. I mean, between this villain hanging tenuously off the edge of a window and all of the broken windows, this really is a precursor to the Die Hard series, I suppose.
Yeah, John McTiernan watched this, started taking notes halfway through.
Yeah.
Or maybe Stephen D'Souza, or I don't know. It was actually a book before it was a movie, and all that shit's in the book, too. But anyways, guess who wakes up out of nowhere for no fucking reason? It's Tommy Jarvis 2.0, and he finds the machete, and he chops off Roy's arm. Roy falls to the ground, and then on right onto the bed of spikes, and then we get the most nonsensical visual in the entire movie. And that has got to be saying something, where we see that Roy is actually the man behind the mask, but he's been wearing two masks. Mm-hmm. What? We didn't even see the second mask. Why have a mask on? Why not just shave his head or something? Like, why does he have to have a full makeup appliance? And how does falling on a bed of spikes split open the face of it?
Do not. No good answers.
It looks like it burst open, it's like, but there's no spikes to his face. Somehow, like, he is positioned just perfectly, the spikes are around his head.
It's worth noting, this second mask obscures the edges of his face. It's a dark shot. We've never seen Roy in the dark before, and it's all rainy. And we haven't seen this character for about 45 minutes, maybe, at this point. Yeah, so
when we saw him in close-up, we got a lot of shaking jowls.
Yeah.
This is completely different lighting. I understand how several of our guests have been, I didn't even know who that person was.
Mm-hmm.
I get it, because you can't. There's no way you could know that that's fucking Roy from the brief flash of his barely lit face.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of another movie that came out roughly around the same time period. It was a movie called Jagged Edge with Glenn Close and Jeff Bridges. And it is a murder mystery in which she is a lawyer who is defending Jeff Bridges who's on trial for the murder of his wife. And then he is acquitted and she is attacked at the end by someone who, spoiler, it turns out to be Jeff Bridges. Except that the reveal of when she takes the mask off and sees who it is so badly done that you actually cannot see who it is. It does not look like, I'm sure you could probably find it online somewhere. It is so poorly done that you did not know in advance who it was. It's like, okay, this is some random person that breaks into her house and tries to kill her. You know, thank God she can run into the arms of Jeff Bridges. Oh, wait, no, he's dead? Oh, okay, I guess that was him. you know, I gotta say, Patrick, I'm gonna argue your point that Roy's reveal was the most nonsensical moment in this movie.
Okay,
I would say that would be a few minutes later when the cop has Roy's wallet. And which contains a photograph of himself in the picture, the little picture insert.
You know, when I was doing the rewatch, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, and I thought after Roy fell, I'm like, okay, well, it was dumb this whole thing with Roy was stupid. The reveal didn't make sense, but at least they didn't do like the psycho, like therapist scene where the guy explains what was going on with the character a whole bunch. Because I had totally forgotten the laziest use of that ever, which is, I guess we just found his wallet on him. And he had all the pertinent evidence inside. A picture of himself, a picture of his son, and clippings about the Crystal Lake massacres. All in the wallet. Didn't even have to go to the apartment for this one, boys.
He has an evidence dungeon in his wallet.
Yeah.
It's portable, so that it's always on him in case he is found.
It's like all they were missing was like a piece of paper with like everybody's names just scrawled and then like, you know, this jagged red line like through each name as he goes down the list.
Yeah, Vic at the very bottom didn't quite get to that one.
Yeah, he doesn't even know half the names, you know, old black cook, you know, old vagrant. Black cook's grandson, vagrant,
blonde lady.
You know, gay couple in old 50s clothing. You know, just, you know, Roy's to-do list.
Yeah, his honeydew is spurious, to say the least. Before we get to that weird-ass psycho reveal, however, there's more nonsense to get through. One of which is we have a nurse at the intake of the hospital, I guess, who is filing her already lacquered nails. Her
yes.
Nails are, now, I'm not an expert in nail technology, okay? I've gone to have a manicure several times. I enjoy it. I went with my son just a couple weeks ago. But it seems to me that if you have already painted your nails, now is not the time to file them.
Not really, no. And she looked. She just could not look more bored and annoyed with this woman and this child who just survived
a mass murder.
It's like she's pissed off at them. It's like she's Roy's living girlfriend.
She has no time for this shit.
It's like, I can't believe Roy was the only guy I liked around here. She really dislikes the two of them. And when you first happened upon Pam and Reggie, it almost looks like she's breastfeeding Reggie. It's a super weird shot.
But yeah, it definitely seems like this nurse had like tickets to Springsteen that night and then this murder happened and she had to stay late. And it's like, well, fuck. Don't get to see the boss. Assuming this is New Jersey.
I think that's as likely a story as any, given the location or what the location is, what we assume. Sheriff Tucker comes in with his hair in the exact same place we saw it last time. I don't think it's possible for his hair to move. And yeah, he's got an evidence dungeon in Roy's wallet.
You know,
I just rewatched the clip and it's hilarious because he's going through the newspaper clippings and one of the newspaper clippings has a picture of Jason.
Yeah, like, where did they get that?
Yeah, it looks like almost like a Bigfoot type picture where he's like looking right at the camera and he's got the mask on. It's like, wait a minute, who took that picture?
I have to wonder, like, since Roy did have these two separate masks on, and we know, as we've established, he's a fan of limited fields of vision, like Jason is. Maybe when he was killing all these people, he just couldn't see very well. And he's like, wait a minute, is that Vic? And then he does the murdering. And then he's like, oh, shit. Once again, the wrong culprit. It's a comedy of errors, really, if they remake this movie. This guy keeps on killing the wrong people.
That photograph of Jason in the newspaper looks like someone took Jason on a perp walk.
Like they just like
captured outside the county courthouse, Jason Voorhees with under mask.
I sort of feel like it's like the Lee Harvey Oswald shooting, where like the they had like the guy next to him looking like really startled.
Meanwhile, the sheriff is explaining all of this to Pam, and she's got the look. She's not even paying attention. And I don't know why she should, because who cares? There's no reasonable explanation for what's just happened. She's just sitting there waiting to take off her fucking eye makeup, and no one will help her. Not even the nurse behind the station who's filing her already painted nails. So after that, she just decides, okay, listen, I gotta go to Tommy's room, because the script says I have to.
Yeah.
She walks in.
Tommy, and... who's in, I guess, the only bedroom this hospital has, because they didn't have no room for Reggie or Pam.
No, oh yeah, and it's one of those standard horror movie hospitals where there's only two people on staff.
Yeah,
one of whom is apparently reading at his bedside. How do you get that gig? The old nurse reading at his bedside, like, oh hi, I was just getting through my novel here. This is also our break room, and so she comes in and talks to Tommy. And they look at one another like, yeah, we went through the shit, didn't we? Yeah, totally. I don't know what this half smile they do at one another is. If at the end of this, if what had happened is they had high-fived and it had freeze-framed like at the end of Tango and Cash, that would have been the best ending. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we don't get that ending. They just kind of, hey there, hi there. Let me stab you with this machete I happen to have underneath the sheets. And then she looks down like, the fuck? God damn it. And he laughs maniacally like the Joker. And then that's the ending number one.
Yeah. Kind of two, because they really could have gone with just they kind of are relieved to be alive. The sheriff explains what happens, fade out. But they have to go for the twist.
True. Okay, so let's say that's ending B.
Uh-huh.
Let's move on to ending C. Tommy wakes up. It's super stormy outside. Mm-hmm. The old lady who's using his room as a break room has disappeared.
Mm.
And we get his, we get yet again his beautiful visage when he's been sweating. Because if this movie has anything, it's full of footage of this guy being moist.
Yeah, it's a very damp movie.
And then he gets orgasm face as he looks at Jason Voorhees now in a red mask, a red striped mask at the end of his bed.
Yeah.
And he kind of has like, oh, it's you. It's one step away from Ghostbusters ghost blowjob.
Yeah, and then he kind of gets this like, yes, master, I accept my fate. Look on his face. It's like, wait, what? Come on.
The main difference between this visage of Jason Voorhees and any of the others that we've seen before is Jason still has all the wounds. He's got the machete wound to his head. Or actually, I guess he's got the axe wound to his head, which is leaking brain matter. And just a lot of blood behind the mask. He's got the blackout eyes. And then he disappears.
Mm.
Where did Jason go?
I think he force ghosted on him. Like I said, I mean, I think that, you know, Tommy, you know, has his orgasm. You know, he experiences the rapture of you know, accepting that he is going to take over the mantle of killing for Jason. Well, why? And again, it doesn't make any sense because it's not something that is carried over into the next movie. No. And then he conveniently somehow has the mask stored in his little cabinet next to his hospital bed.
Well, let's quickly go through the list of contents of that drawer.
Well,
a hockey mask from a murderer, recent, not imaginary, a real murderer, a belt, underwear, and a knife. Case or wallet, I can't tell which, but all of that has been folded and put into a drawer in his hospital room.
And it's a kitchen knife. Where did he get this kitchen knife from?
I don't know. I don't know where anything happens. I don't know why any of this is happening. Zach, do you have any solutions for us?
I suppose maybe there was some kind of like, when he was accepted into the halfway house, hey, if I end up in the hospital, just my emergency medical facts, I'm going to need a hockey mask. I'm going to need a knife. I'm going to need a belt. I'm going to need some pants. Just those are my comfort food. If I ever get put in the hospital, make
like
sure
he's got
they're
a
there.
Go bag.
Yeah.
I really think it's just shoddy police work on the local constabulary where the mask came off of Roy when he fell. And so when they're collecting evidence, they're like, oh, anybody lose a mask? And then just, you know, kind of threw it on the Tommy stretcher or taken away to the hospital.
You know, maybe
it's probably this kid. It's probably this kid. He'll say he plays hockey. Let's leave it with him.
This hospital is too small and understaffed. We know that. We know the police and EMTs are incompetent in this town. Maybe they just share like an evidence locker and a hospital room. It's just one room to save space in this town.
Just like the community center.
Yeah.
Well, the nurse is taking a break in there. So yeah, it's a multi-purpose room for sure.
You know, they're having the big spring dance, in the room right next door to his on the following weekend.
So Pam is now just outside the door. She hears a large crash. She runs in, and in very Voorhees-like fashion, the window has been broken out.
Yeah.
And there's a violent storm happening outside still. And she's like, what the fuck? And then the door closes, and behind her is Tommy in the blue hockey mask raising a knife that he has for reasons we can't tell. And that's ending number C. And yeah, that's
which is, D, which part is,
five. I mean, Jason fading out could have been C, because maybe it implies he got over the trauma of Jason. I don't know.
But yeah, I would say this was D. And again, okay, it's an ending that is not carried over into the next movie.
Well,
no.
My favorite thing about ending D is it's basically the same ending as ending B. It's just him killing Pam a second time.
But from a different angle. Like, yeah. That other angle was frightening, but if I get her from behind, that's more my style.
And with a different weapon. He's a machete in B, and then has a kitchen knife in D.
So I feel like the endings go like a regular denouement, where it's like, okay, this is wrapped up. And then there's like, but what if Tommy's a killer now? And then there's like, but Tommy's still haunted and or getting over Jason. And then they just go back to, what if Tommy's a killer now? Just play the hits again one more time.
Yeah. No, but wait, let's ponder whether Tommy's a killer now.
Stay tuned after the credits for a cookie about whether Tommy is a killer now.
Because these things
turns out Thanos is really behind all of this.
Because Freddy these things Krueger are contagious, wants to hire apparently. Tommy
for the new initiative after the credits.
Yeah, I can see that. Who's the doctor in Halloween?
Loomis, Dr. Loomis.
Dr. Loomis is basically the Nick Fury of this entire thing. He's just gathering psychos together. It's in some sort of Suicide Squad. Yeah, I like it. Better than Suicide Squad.
That's true.
Patrick, we made it.
Oh my god.
Oh, it's over, made it.
It's over.
I we could sit here and review this movie, but I think we've done it. We've told everyone how we feel.
Yeah.
I'm older. I'm wearier. I'm more cynical.
Brighter times ahead for you guys.
Yes, we still have Jason Takes Manhattan to look forward to.
Yeah.
And I have
which is
going
to be a breeze compared to this.
I have almost as much to say about that, but probably in a less angry fashion.
A man gets his head punched off in that movie. It's not all bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a magnificent motion picture.
It's worth it alone for when Jason hassles punks in Times Square. I mean, really, the movie builds up to it, and then it happens, and then who the fuck cares what happens after it? Because it's never really going to get any better than that. Sure. There's no way him turning into a mysterious toxic waste baby at the sewer at the end. Spoiler alert for a movie 3 movies from now. But yeah, that actually happens. That's Friday the 13th part 5. So let's get into it. Let's play America's least favorite game show, probably because they're not all aware of it quite yet. And that is Choose Your Own Death Venture.
I love this
and
game. It's like you're playing Clue, but you're playing as Mr. Body.
Exactly. You have to decide exactly how you would be dispatched if you had to choose from the deaths that we see in this particular section of the movie. So I ask both of you, would you rather die as Duke does of a throat slashing, but with gum still in your mouth? Or would you like to go out like Dr. Letter with a throat slashing, head spiking combo, a 1-2 punch? Speaking of 1-2 punches, we've got George, who takes 2 stab wounds to the eyes and gets defenestrated. Mm-hmm. And he may or may not be dead at the point that we see him. So of blood loss, let's call it blood loss. Or would you like to go out like Roy, who is both hit in the chest with a tractor and nicked in the shoulder by a chainsaw, stabbed in the almost groin, and then has his arm chopped off and he lands on a bed of spikes? I look to you, Zach, as our guest.
Oh, it's a lot of great
your answer.
Great off-screen options, mostly. I will say, when you were talking about George, I found a little bit of appeal on that, because there is a chance George just survived as a blind man, I suppose.
He might have pulled off like a blind fury start sort of life after that.
Yeah,
as a
maybe.
Blind samurai. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess I gotta go, you know, it's go big or go home, really. And I think I'm gonna go with Roy, because one, at least I get a little bit of attention out of the thing instead of just showing up like a fucking prop at the last minute, a forgotten shoe in the back of the closet or something. I mean, and plus, that's a death. I'm like the Miss Doubtfire killer that people are going to be talking about for a long time. I could live with that. That's a nice legacy to have under your belt.
Well, you're going to have to walk around with all that stuff in your wallet, and that's going to make it tough.
True.
It's going to, when I've you sit got... down, you're always going to feel it because you're sitting on all those photos of yourself.
I know.
The son that you left behind.
I'm going to have to get rid of some of these sub-club cards to make room for the newspaper clippings.
It's very true. I mean, you're just going to have to pay for your $5 footlongs from now on without hope of getting a free one after 10. But that is the fate that you suffer. All right, Gina, what about you?
Well, Dr. Matt and Duke were you probably best remembered for being absolutely terrible at their jobs. I mean, really, when it comes right down to it, Dr. Matt is probably the most responsible for everything that has transpired in this movie.
1,000%.
He is not a good psychiatrist. He should never have been left in charge of troubled teens. It is really the everything that happens. It's his fault, and I'm really surprised that they left his death on screen or off screen, I should say. Right. I'm gonna have to go with George because even though he does disappear for most of the movie, I would say he's probably one of the more fondly remembered characters, of which there are very few in this movie. And I want to be remembered in my death, even if I'm not around very much and might take people a minute or two to remember who I was. Once they do remember who I was, I would like to be remembered fondly. So yeah, I'm going to have to go. I like to think that it was, you know, in keeping with the general carelessness, let's call it, of the movie. I'm pretty sure that the actor playing George, still, you know, very visibly breathing, was just they said fuck it, we don't have enough film to do this a second time, and that he actually was dead. So yeah, I'm going to have to go with good old Grampy George.
Yeah. I honestly believe it was like a camera test, and they're like, we got to cut out. We got to move. Otherwise, we're going to lose this entire day. It's like, oh, camera test is good enough. That just sounds like the incompetence of this movie. All right. I think that's a good choice. I am going to go with Duke. And there are only two reasons for this. One, I like chewing gum. And two, I've always wanted to be in the front seat of an ambulance. So
well,
there.
Yeah. Live your dreams. Follow your dreams, man.
That's what I want. That's what I get. And I just have to have my throat slashed because of it.
You really want to be in the front of an ambulance more than the back of an ambulance. Although it really doesn't do Duke any good, does it?
No. No. Hey. He ends up the same as most of the people he transports.
Pat just came here to chew gum and have his throat slit, and he's all out of gum, apparently.
That's a point to Zach. All right, everybody. That is the Kill by Kill podcast for today. Hey, Zach, where can people find out more about you and hear you?
You can hear me two places. In the Stage of Fools podcast with previous guest Shannon Camp, previous guest on this show, where we review E's terrible, soapy, goofy sex romp comedy drama, The Royals. Or on The Revisionists, which is a comedy podcast where we look at an event from history, one person gives a true account, and one person gives an absolutely batshit bonkers fake crazy account, and then we vote on which becomes the real history of the world going forward.
I like it. Very nice. Okay, Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
I write about 70s, 80s, and occasionally early 90s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
Excellent. Check it out, people. Get those podcasts. Look it up on the internet at tuneintonight.wordpress.com. com. Hey, do you want to talk to us about something? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can reach out to us on Twitter at KillByKillPod. Got something longer than 140 characters you want to talk about? Send us an email, killbykillpod@gmail.com. As always, we implore you, we beg you, we're down on our soot-covered knees in the mud begging for you to rate and review us on iTunes, because that's the way we get heard and seen by more people. If you would do that and write in that review your favorite kill from the Friday the 13th series, we will read it here on this air. That is my promise to you, the listener. As always, we thank you so much for listening and sharing with friends. People, we're done. Next time, oh my God, it's getting so much better. Jason, spoiler alert, lives.
What?
And the way he lives is batshit fucking insane. We've got great people lined up for Jason Lives. Listen, this is getting fantastic, and we're so happy that you're with us. To the people who've been here from the beginning, we love you. The people who have just come on lately, we love you just as much. It's great. Come on, join the party. This has been the Kill by Kill podcast for myself and Zach and Gina. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.